This is just going to take a minute.
Do you want to say hello? Come on, come on, come on. Come here, nice and close.
Hello, my name's Isabel and I'm 7 years old and I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you.
Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Christopher Gribben, an adjunct lecturer in classics at La Trobe University. This is episode CCIV, Octavian's Illyrian War. Part of the making of Octavian was the victories he had early in his career. He defeated his rivals, conquered territory, and united the Senate behind him whether they liked it or not. One of these territories was Illyria, in which he conducted campaigns during the quiet years before his final battles against Cleopatra and Antony. It is perhaps in Illyria that we see Octavian display his greatest acts of bravery, if not ability. Here's Christopher Gribben.
Between 35 and 33 BC, Octavian conducted a couple of campaigns in Illyria, which is the area that is today mostly Croatia, that eastern coast of the Adriatic. And he conducted a couple of campaigns to bring into line, essentially, the people who were living there, consolidate Roman power and authority in the area, as well as, you know, extend it a little bit and to bring himself in some, you know, some cash and various other things as well. Mm. And takes place at what is, I think, a really interesting period in his life. So 36 BC, Octavian has just dealt with Sextus Pompeius. He's been causing all kinds of trouble with the grain supply and various other things and in Sicily. He has also just got rid of Lepidus, so one of the three triumvirs. Lepidus is being disposed of at this point.
Mm.
And there's a growing sense of rivalry between Octavian and Mark Antony. They're not actually fighting each other at this point. That's yet to come. But certainly there's some vying for power that's happening. But at this particular time, Mark Antony is off with Cleopatra in Egypt. In 36 BC, he has an attempted campaign to invade Parthia. That goes very poorly. Octavian's over in Italy thinking, well, what am I going to do? And what he decides to do is to launch a campaign into Illyria.
Okay, and what is the status of Illyria at this point? What does it mean to the Roman Empire? It's not part of the Roman Empire strictly.
The Romans have been mucking around in there from 230 BC, really. So they have been going over there with military forces relatively regularly, rearranging things and then removing the army, but maintaining a relationship. It's not actually a province. It doesn't have a governor as such. But the Romans have established a series of friendships, as they like to call them, with various peoples that are living in that area.
Mm.
So sometimes that's just purely a mutual aid treaty. Sometimes those people have to provide some sort of tribute to the Romans. It varies a bit. It's a patchwork of communities living along the eastern coast of the Adriatic. It's important to understand the geography of this area in that there's a very tall mountain range, the Dinaric Alps, that runs relatively close to the coast along the East Adriatic. And there's only a few places where you can pass through that mountain range. And a lot of points, it's actually too hard to traverse.
Mm.
The Romans, prior to this, haven't been too worried about what's happening on the other side of the mountains. They've really only been focusing on the coast. But yeah, they do have a series of relationships. And particularly from about the middle of the first century BC, there seem to have been quite a number of Roman settlers moving into towns along the coast there. There are, in fact, a number of towns that become Roman colonies somewhere around this period, somewhere between in the 40s, 30s or 20s BC. And in most cases, we can't actually narrow that down. So somewhere sort of between 50 and 20 BC, they become Roman colonies. So whether they actually have become colonies before Octavian's campaigns or whether they become colonies after Octavian's campaigns is not entirely clear. But either way, there's definitely Romans living in a number of settlements, conducting trade, you know, pursuing business in various ways prior to Octavian's venture, and there may be some actual Roman colonies there as well. They've been heavily involved in the area, but they haven't officially turned it into a Roman province at this point.
And what is it that pushes Octavian to launch this campaign to intervene? Is there something going on in particular? Are the Illyrians just revolting in general? Are they not giving tribute? What's happening?
There's a number of different theories that have been put forward. So we have two main ancient sources for this. We have Appian and Dio Cassius. And Dio tells us that some of the Illyrian tribes, he says they openly revolted, without going into too much detail of exactly what that entailed. But he does go on to explain, and Appian confirms this as well, that some of the Illyrians had been raiding some of their neighbours, so including some of the Roman territory. We are also told that some of them haven't been paying tribute that they've owed. And we also have another theory from another ancient author, Vellaeus Paterculus, who tells us that Octavian's main motivation was to keep his troops from being spoiled by idleness.
Okay.
But there's been a number of modern theories that have been proposed as well for reasons that he might have invaded. One of them was for Octavian to win over the Roman populace. Demonstrating that you could be a successful military leader was a key part of rising to prominence in Roman politics. So this was a chance for Octavian to get out there and show himself to be this great victorious general. Similarly, it's been suggested he was trying to emulate Julius Caesar, his adoptive father, and someone that he's traded on significantly in terms of his career. And so just as Julius Caesar heads off to Gaul and conducts his campaign, well, this is Octavian's little version of that as well. So that's also been suggested. And it's also been thought that he may be trying to contrast himself with Antony. So Antony's over in the east. He's had an unsuccessful campaign to invade Parthia, and here's Octavian's chance to have a successful campaign invading Illyria. And in fact, what we're told by Appian is that after the campaign, that Octavian informed the Senate that he had freed Italy from the savage tribes that had so often raided it. And Appian says that he explains this is by way of contrast with Antony's slothfulness.
Okay.
So there's definitely a little bit of that going on. And it's even been suggested that it may, in fact, be a little bit more than that, in that the east coast of the Adriatic has often been used as a staging post for military interventions, either for military invasions of Italy or conversely for military interventions into the Balkans. And so it's been suggested that Octavian may also have been keen to get himself a foothold there, either to prevent Antony from getting a foothold there and then invading Italy, or because Octavian was thinking to the future and the possibility of making a move into the Balkans at some point, into Antony's territory.
Okay.
So either way, it could be useful to have strong control over that east coast of the Adriatic. It's probably a bit of all of them.
Yeah, okay. Before we get any further then, can we talk about the sources then and how they're treating the events?
One of the things we know about Appian is that his account seems to have drawn very heavily on Octavian's own account of the campaign. That gives us a really interesting perspective. We have some sense of how Octavian was trying to spin that, but it probably makes it slightly less reliable than we might like. And certainly we know this from other things about Octavian, is that he was never one to let the truth get in the way of a good story. And, you know, looking at Appian's account, it's very notable how it portrays Octavian as a very good general, constantly taking part in combat, leading the troops from the front and being there the whole time, even getting injured a couple of times. There's this really interesting mix between portraying him as sort of ruthlessly dispelling enemies of Rome and then also showing great clemency towards other people. And he kind of seems to switch between the two of them.
Mm.
And there seem to have been a number of commanders with Octavian. They don't get a lot of mentions in Appian, but we do get a mention of a number of them in Dio. That makes Appian an interesting but perhaps not entirely reliable narrator. Appian's text is quite interesting in itself because he talks about Roman history from the point of view of different ethnicities, essentially, and the different ways that these people came into the Roman Empire. So the Illyrian books are an appendix to the books on the Macedonians, which we don't have anymore. But the Macedonians bordered on the Illyrians down in the southeast. So it makes sense to have lumped them together.
But it also tells us about the history of interactions between Romans and Illyrians, doesn't it?
That's right, yes. It goes right back to the 3rd century BC when the Romans first started interacting with the Illyrians and various wars that they had.
Yeah, okay. So just to give a bit more context on the Illyrians, we're not talking about a united people who identify themselves and have, you know, a king of Illyria or something like that. This is city territories, those sort of things?
Yeah, we often refer to them as tribes. They seem to be slightly bigger than traditional city-state, but not necessarily very large.
Mm.
What we find when we have a look at Illyrian history is that it's constantly changing, that we keep having references to people being in different places, and sometimes their territory gets bigger and sometimes it gets smaller as they conquer their neighbours and so on and so forth. But it's absolutely not one united polity with one leader. It's a whole lot of small communities divided into a number of different tribes, but each of those tribes, you know, at least in some of those cases, had multiple different political units that made them up as well. If these people had actually been able to band together, they probably could have defeated the Roman army that was coming in, but because they're all dispersed in these little kingdoms, they don't.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Each of those is often looking out for their own advantage. So many of them are happy to go over to the Romans without much of a fight, and then others of them put up a big fight, but they don't have necessarily the manpower to resist the Romans by themselves.
Okay, so what did Octavian's campaign look like then? 35 BCE, he decides to launch his campaign. What does he do?
The first campaign has a couple of different strands to it. So there's a naval campaign against the islands. So there's a number of islands on the east coast of the Adriatic which have fallen afoul of the Romans for one reason or another. Some of them are conducting piratical raids on shipping and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So he sorts that out with a naval campaign, and then he has a land campaign that heads inland as well.
And he himself leads the land campaign, doesn't he?
He does, that's right. According to Suetonius, this is one of the two campaigns against foreign enemies that Octavian actually leads himself. So it's a big deal from that point of view.
Yeah. So where do they go?
This campaign goes against the Iapydes, who are located in today Croatia. They have apparently been raiding into Aquileia and Tegeste, which is modern Trieste, so towns in what's the northeast of Italy. And we're told that the Iapydes that were located on the coastal side of the mountains were relatively easy to conquer, but on the other side of the mountains, it becomes much more challenging.
So that's terrain related?
Partly. Well, first of all, Octavian and the army need to get through the mountains, and the route we think that they took was starting at Senj on the coast and then making their way through. So there's a bit of a pass in the mountains. It's not an easy pass to get through, but it is relatively easy compared to the others. And that's where they start to encounter struggles already, because as they start moving inland, the Iapydes adapt something of a guerrilla tactics. So they start felling trees to block the path. They're hiding in the forest and then jumping out and attacking the Roman army as it's moving through and then retreating back into the forest. So that already becomes a bit of a challenge, and Octavian has to deal with that. But he makes his way through the mountains till he gets to the chief town of the Iapydes, which is a place called Mechelen, today near town of Ogulin in Croatia.
Yeah.
That's where he lays siege to the main town, and that's where the major battle against the Iapydes takes place.
Okay, so this is something that Octavian doesn't come across very often. I don't often hear about him going and doing a siege at this point in his life. What do the Iapydes respond to? I guess they're given the chance to surrender, but they don't.
Yeah, we're told that the Iapydes have 3,000 warlike and well-armed youths, and they also have a number of siege engines, which they'd captured earlier in the 40s from Brutus when he'd been fighting Mark Antony and Octavian in the area. A walled city that they can retreat behind, which is in fact what they do. The Romans manage to capture the wall, and then the people build a second wall inside that. At this point, then we have the Romans conducting traditional siege warfare. The Romans build a mound near the walls and then throw over a couple of bridges, four bridges in fact, to launch their way into the city. Appian provides us with quite a nice account. What we're told is that some of the barbarians, that's the people from Mechelen, ran it from the parapet to meet the Romans who were crossing. The Romans have set up these bridges, and the idea is that they can run across these bridges onto the tops of the city walls and fight.
But the Mechelens can run back at
you. But of course, bridges work both ways, so yeah.
Yeah.
So some of them are running across to meet the Romans on the bridge, while others, unseen, sought to undermine the bridges with their long spears. They were much encouraged at seeing one bridge fall and a second one follow on top of it. When a third one went down, a regular panic overtook the Romans, so that no one ventured on the fourth bridge until Augustus, Octavian, leapt down from the tower and reproached them. As they were not roused to their duty by his words, he seized a shield and sprang upon the bridge himself. Agrippa and Hero is possibly Tiberius Claudius Nero, the father of the future emperor Tiberius. So Agrippa and Hero, two of the generals, and one of his bodyguard, Lucius, and Volas, ran with him, only these four and a few armour bearers. He had almost crossed the bridge when the soldiers, overcome by shame, rushed after him in crowds. Then the bridge, being overweighted, fell also, and the men on it went down in a heap. Some were killed, and others were carried away with broken bones. Augustus was injured in the right leg and in both arms. Nevertheless, he ascended the tower with his signals forthwith and showed himself safe and sound, lest dismay should arise from a report of his death. In order that the enemy might not fancy that he was going to give in and retire, he began to construct new bridges, by which means he struck terror into the Metulians, who thought that they were contending against an unconquerable will. So that's from Appian, chapter 20 of the Illyrians.
Wow. That is so unlike so much that I know about Octavian. To be that dynamic, to be leading so forcefully and effectively. And I can't believe that he wrote about the bridge collapsing if it was based on his own account.
Yeah.
Because that just seems to be like a bit of ineptness.
It does. These obviously weren't very well constructed bridges, I got to say. And yeah, I mean, there's a number of things that don't quite ring true about the whole account. I find it hard to believe that it was really just five men crossing across this bridge against the entire
Oh, it's very cinematic, isn't it?
It's very cinematic. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Octavian leading from the front, like Julius Caesar, like Alexander the Great, leading the forces into battle, shaming his men when they weren't as brave as he was.
Come men, follow me. Creak, creak, creak.
He gets injured, but he gets back up again. And I feel there's a number of reasons to doubt a number of elements of this story.
It's all true. I want that to be true. It's too good a story.
It is too good a story. But as I say, Octavian's never one to let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Okay, so constructed more bridges.
Constructs more bridges, at which point the Metulians surrender. There's no point. They offer 50 hostages and they then allow Octavian to station a garrison. This settlement has two hills on it and they say you can have the highest hill and you can put your garrison there and we'll take the lower hill.
Okay. All right. So that's to deter them from doing anything in the future.
That seems to be the idea, but it doesn't really seem to work terribly well. So what we're told is that when the Roman garrison enters the town, they then demand that the locals give up their weapons, and that doesn't go down very well at all.
Mm.
The people of Metulum decide that they're going to attack the Romans. They shut their wives and children in the council chambers and post guards on that with an order for them to burn the building down if anything goes wrong.
If something happens to the men, just kill everyone because that's more preferable than being turned over to the Romans.
Exactly right.
Ouch, yeah.
And they attack, but of course the Romans have the higher hill, so they have the advantage there and they defeat the attack. And then the guards do exactly what they're told to do. They set fire to the council chambers. And we're told by Appian that many of the women killed their children and themselves. Others, holding in their arms their children still alive, leapt into the flames. Thus all the Metulian youth perished in battle and the greater part of the non-combatants by fire. Their city was entirely consumed and large as it was, not a trace of it now remains.
Wow. Is that true?
There are traces, but not a lot. Still an uninhabited site, wasn't re-inhabited, and so, yeah, it's a forested hill.
Yeah, wow. Okay. That seems excessive, but, you know, I'm not the one fighting against the Romans. What do I know?
Yeah. Well, we're told that after this, the remainder of the Iapetus were terror-stricken and surrendered to Octavian.
Not surprised. Is that a campaign and that is successful, or there's still more of Illyria to deal with, isn't there?
There's still plenty more. Yeah. And this is where Octavian decides that he's going to change tack a little bit and he decides to head inland. So he then moves his campaign towards Segesta, which is the modern town of Sisak in Croatia. And interestingly, this is new territory. So the Iapetus had already previously been brought into the Roman world.
Yeah.
And they'd already had a relationship with the Romans, but the people further inland hadn't at all. So Octavian is deciding he's going to go and conquer new territory. And in fact, Dio tells us he had no complaint to bring against them, not having been wronged by them in any way. but he wanted both to give his soldiers practice and to support them at the expense of an alien people, for he regarded every demonstration against a weaker party as just when it pleased the man who was their superior in arms.
That feels like the worst reason to have a campaign.
It's because he felt like it. It was basically the reason.
If somebody was having a campaign against me and that was their reasoning, I'd just be so insulted.
Yeah. By the time he gets to Mechelen, he's already made it across the main bit of the mountains, and then there's a large plain area which then leads out to the Danube. So he's making his way towards that.
Mm.
In terms of the people who are living there, Dio also tells us a little bit about those people. They lead the most miserable existence of all mankind. They are not well off as regards either soil or climate. They cultivate no olives and produce no wine except to a very slight extent, and a wretched quality at that, but drink as well as eat both barley and millet. For all that, they are considered the bravest of all men of whom we have knowledge, for they are very high-spirited, bloodthirsty, as men who possess nothing that makes an honourable life worthwhile.
This mustn't go down well in Croatia these days.
Okay? I think people have mostly got over the slight from Dio, but interestingly, actually, Dio was in fact the governor of this area in his life.
So he
goes on to mention he knows this from personal experience. It's not just hearsay.
Somebody's got a chip on their shoulder.
He does. And I've got to say, generally, the Illyrians don't get portrayed very well in our Greek and Roman sources. Polybius, who's our other major source for the Illyrians, he only ever says negative things about them. He's got nothing nice to say about any of them. They're always being portrayed as greedy and drunkards and being headstrong and reckless and all these kinds of things. It's always negative.
This is the Romans' first venture into this area. Do they get any sort of encounters or resistance at all?
So as they make their way through there, in the beginning, the natives simply abandon their villages. And Octavian doesn't destroy or plunder them. He seems to be wanting to try to get on good terms with them and try to reach a sort of peaceful arrangement in the whatever sense you can say you make a peaceful arrangement when you march in with an army and then start negotiating. But then the natives start launching a number of attacks on them. Again, this kind of guerrilla fighting where they retreat into the forest and then launch their attacks. And when that starts happening, Octavian starts looting and burning. Eventually, they end up at Segesta, which is the capital of the area. Octavian then besieges the city for 30 days. And there we have some accounts of there being a number of conflicts happening there, both on land and on water as well. So it's actually located on a riverside. And we're told that there were a number of naval battles that took place between the natives and the Romans at this point.
Does that mean the Romans had ships there, or they had a raft with a couple of archers?
The Romans had ships there. We're not entirely sure where the ships came from. We're told in one of the sources that they were made by allies of the Romans, but we're not quite sure what allies there were in the area to be making ships.
Yeah.
Another one suggests that Octavian was building some ships in order to launch a campaign further inland or further along the river at a later date. And then we're told that the natives constructed their own ships.
I'm very skeptical as to these ships. But so, anyway,
yeah, okay. I don't know what these ships exactly looked like, or you know, how big a naval battle this was, whether it was just a skirmish on the water. But at any rate, there's some fighting happening. The people of Segesta managed to get some allies to come to their aid, but the Romans managed to intercept the allies and defeat them before they get there.
Okay.
And at that point, either they surrender, according to Dio, or they're defeated, according to Appian. So, you know, depends on which way you want to take that.
Yeah.
But after a 30-day siege, the people of Segesta surrender. Octavian stops at that point. That's the furthest point that he reaches on this campaign.
Okay.
He then stations a garrison there. We're told of 25 cohorts. So if they were full cohorts, that could be something in the vicinity of 12,000 men. He stations his men there and then he heads back to Rome.
Okay. Why didn't he keep going?
We don't know why he didn't keep going. We don't know, in fact, why he got there in the first place.
Okay.
We have a couple of suggestions. We are told by Appian that Octavian was planning on using Segesta as a base for a campaign against the Dacians and the Bastarnae, which is a tribe on the other side of the Danube. So the Romans haven't made their way all the way up to the Danube at this point. That will later be the border of the Roman Empire, but at this stage it isn't. Julius Caesar had had a plan to invade Dacia and make his way up to the Danube. He never actually managed to follow through on that. So Appian suggests that Octavian is planning to do something similar to that. Perhaps this is again him trying to emulate Julius Caesar. It's also been suggested that Octavian may have been trying to create a buffer zone against the peoples on the other side of the Danube to protect Rome, and particularly to protect northeast Italy. So if the people from the other side of the Danube were going to invade Italy, that would be one of the key ways they could have done it, would be moving down through this area and then down through what is today Slovenia into the northeast of Italy. So by creating a base in that area, he provides a degree of protection. And this is a typical Roman tactic. Let's defend ourselves on somebody else's territory before they get to us, rather than actually having to worry about fighting on our area.
Okay, so that seems to be a much more successful siege, as in not everyone was slaughtered. So Octavian is now heading back to Rome, and what are his plans going forward from this point?
The campaign is successful, and in fact, Octavian is awarded a triumph by the Senate, so they're obviously recognising it as successful as well. He defers that, and that doesn't actually happen until 29 BC, and he's decided he's going to go off and conquer somewhere else. So this time he's decided he's going to set out to Britain and conduct an operation there.
Right.
And he gets as far as Gaul.
That's not Britain.
It's on the way. He's getting on the way when some of the Illyrians revolt. So the people from Segesta and some others as well decide that they're not happy about having the Romans there. So at that point, he decides he needs to head back and conduct another campaign in Illyria.
Was this so much of a dangerous thing that he would interrupt a campaign to Britain, though? Well, clearly, but I didn't get the impression that they would be that much of a threat that need his personal attention.
I think they were potentially a threat. I think one of the big problems with the Illyrians is that they are very close to Italy. Later, when there's a rebellion in this area, some of the Roman sources talk about this as actually being a really serious threat. The Romans don't have a wall around Italy. So once barbarians have made it into Italy, then it's open for a lot of destruction to take place.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, Octavian thought it was serious enough to warrant attention.
Mm.
That was probably a reasonable assumption on his part.
Okay. All right. So back to Illyria he goes.
It seems that the revolt is largely taken care of by other people before he even gets there.
Mm.
But having got there, he decides to launch a campaign against the Delmati.
So while I'm here.
The Delmati are another people that have been causing trouble. So they're in a slightly different part of Illyria. They're further along the coast, near the area that is today split.
Mm.
They had a relationship with the Romans earlier on, but they had been in rebellion for about 10 years at this point. And in fact, Julius Caesar's general Gabinius had launched a campaign against them in 48 BC and been defeated. So the Delmati possessed a number of standards that they had taken from the Roman army at this time. And Octavian says, well, wouldn't it be a great idea to go and get those back and to bring the Delmati back in line?
That would be a very good thing to do.
That's what he figures. And so that's exactly what he does.
Okay.
He attacks. Again, we have another siege, this time of the town of Promona, near the modern town of Drniš in Croatia. He has some problems with his own army happening here. One of the cohorts that was meant to be guarding the city gets attacked and they desert.
Mm.
And so, again, we have another part of Appian where he tells us what a wise commander and tough commander Octavian is. And we're told at this point that that cohort is then decimated. That is, that one in 10 men are killed by the other men. The remaining men are put on barley instead of wheat for the rest of the summer.
You don't often hear about a decimation.
No, it's very rare. It's there. It's sort of officially on the books as a punishment that a general can
implement. But for it to actually happen.
But it very rarely actually seems to happen.
So would that have been Octavian's call?
I would presume so, yeah. And Appian is, or Octavian himself, is keen to show himself as being that, you know, you don't muck around with him. I think that's one of the key things you see in a lot of his propaganda. If you're on good terms with him, everything is great.
Yeah.
Everything will go well for you.
But you sleep with his daughter.
Yeah, things don't go well for you.
Wow.
If you turn against him, he's ruthless in getting revenge. So,
okay.
Or meeting out punishment, as you like.
Okay. How does this siege go?
He's successful in this siege. And it also seems that he's blockaded the Delmati.
Mm.
So he's stopped imports coming into the area. And what we're told is that they're running out of food and they surrender. And they return the standards, which were taken back in 48, and they give them back to Octavian, who then brings them back to Rome, where he proudly puts them on display, either in the portico of Octavia or the portico of Cneius Octavius,
Yeah, okay. And as for the Dalmatians?
As for the Dalmatians, they then are forced to pay arrears in tribute that they had owed to the Romans. They give a number of hostages, and one of the neighbouring tribes also does the same thing. They decide it's not worth fighting the Romans, so they're brought into line.
Okay, so at this point, that is another successful campaign in Illyria for Octavian. At what point does it become just Romanized altogether? Is it long after this? Is that part of this process that is going through now?
This is a big step on the way. So as I mentioned before, it's about this time that a number of Roman colonies get set up along the coastal area. So that's going to be a key part of the Romanization happening there as well.
Yeah.
There's another big campaign that happens that really pushes the border further inland. It's that point that they move into having the Danube as the border of the Roman Empire. So they do another push, at which point they really then fill in the gaps, and it actually becomes a Roman province somewhere between 32 and 27 BC. We're not quite sure exactly when.
Oh, but that's, you know, within the space of a few years of this event.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's shortly after this that they appoint a governor and say this is now Roman territory that we're going to control. And then as a little bit after that, they do another push where they move the border all the way to the Danube. There's then a large rebellion that happens between 6 and 9 AD. After that's put down, the area is pacified and it becomes increasingly Romanized after that.
Okay. And Octavian himself, he finally celebrates his triumph for this campaign in 29 BCE. So a few years after this.
That's right. He celebrates his victory in Dalmatia and other places as well. He throws in a bit of Gaul and Germany, I think, as well. And then also throws in the Battle of Actium against Antony and Cleopatra and the defeat of Egypt, and throws them all together into this massive three-day triple triumph.
That was Christopher Gribben, an adjunct lecturer in classics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. It's great to finally have Chris on Emperors of Rome. If you'd like to hear more of him, he's a regular guest on my other podcast, When in Rome. If you'd like to follow us on our socials, Emperors of Rome is on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Chris is at Classics Melb. I am at Nightlight Guy. And the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we look at the life and rule of Cleopatra Selene, daughter of Cleopatra and Antony. Emperors of Rome is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, and on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.